Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Last fall, the FBI reported personal attacks motivated by bias or prejudice in 2018 reached a 16-year high. When we hear stories of hate crimes or people being bullied, harassed, or treated unfairly, we know it's wrong. But what if we were witness to an incident? Would we step in and do something? We might think, of course I would. But in the moment, it may not be clear how best to address the situation, or we might have concerns about our safety or the safety of others. Training people to analyze situations and assess how best to respond is one of the goals of Training Active Bystanders. The program was developed by Quabbin Mediation and was offered in Falmouth last month. And joining us to discuss the training is Sharon Tracy. She's Executive Director of Quabbin Mediation and one of the individuals who developed the Training Active Bystanders program. She joins us on the phone. Welcome, Sharon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure. In studio of Beryl Domingo, Training Active Bystanders Coordinator at Quabbin Mediation. Good morning, Beryl.
Good morning, Mindy. Thank you.
And Pamela Rothstein, Super Member of No Place for Hate Falmouth, the organization that brought the training to Cape Cod. Good morning, Pamela.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right, so Sharon, as the name suggests, Quabbin Mediation has been involved in conflict resolution programs for a number of years. When and why did you develop the Training Active Bystanders program?
We developed it in 2006-2007, and it was in response to a report that a rise in violence, particularly in the communities where we are based in the North Quabbin. We'd been working in the schools for quite a long time and decided that we needed a program that sort of bridged the gap between peer mediation and conflict resolution. There'd been an incident that happened in a nearby town where one student beat another one to death with a baseball bat. The students in the school had known there was going to be a fight. There were students present. And they all said afterwards, we didn't know what to do. So Susan Wallace, who's our training director, and I went and met with this psychology professor from UMass who is an expert in why people help and don't help others. He's also, interestingly enough, a Holocaust survivor. And over the course of the summer, we developed, we sort of decanted his brain, and we got a doctoral-level course, which we then translated that information into a curriculum that high school students could teach to middle school students, and they did. There was an evaluation, an exhaustive evaluation, qualitative and quantitative, that showed there had been a 20% reduction in harm doing and a rise in leadership development in the schools where we did this program. So then fast forward to there was this election not that long ago, and we were seeing, you know, as the FBI noted, a rise in not just hate crimes, but hate speech, hate actions against many people. We were approached by the social justice chair of Temple out in eastern Massachusetts. He said, we want a program that we can present in the community settings. The one we had been doing in the schools was six lessons long, about five and a half hours. And he's like, we need 2.5 or 3 hours. So he talked us into it. We created this program. We always use a training for trainers model. So we taught the program and we trained. We've probably trained over 100 people in Massachusetts to teach this curriculum at this point. And we are so grateful that Beryl Domingo, who's an ACE trainer, is coordinating the program in the U.S.
Yeah. We'll get to Beryl in a second. Sharon, there have been far too many incidents over the years when people stood by and watched someone being assaulted, and as you mentioned, even killed with this boy that was killed with a baseball bat. Mm-hmm. Psychologists have studied this phenomenon and labeled it the bystander effect. So tell us a little bit more about the bystander effect.
Well, and Beryl can go into this in more depth, but there are five factors that prevent people from stepping in when they're bystanders. And then there's a number of factors that promote people stepping in. So in our curriculum, we talk about what those inhibitors are. And once people know what's holding them back, it helps them step forward, interestingly enough. And then we go into, you know, specific skills. We teach, this course is an analyzing situations and deciding what you personally have the power to do in that situation or afterwards. We don't have, like, if this happens, then you do this. People figure it out themselves.
Yeah. Beryl, I would think some of the fears about stepping in are people are fearful for their own safety, right?
Yes, absolutely. Oftentimes people, also sometimes people are just really shocked at what they see and what they witness or hear, because they may not have been aware that these kinds of things happen. And then they're not sure what to do. They feel completely frozen in the situation. And the fear of perhaps making a fool of yourself can withhold people from reacting or responding. A fear of retaliation, fear of potential violence. People don't want to escalate a situation either. So there's always a worry, like, what if I do something that just makes it worse? Mm. So these kinds of things are things that go through people's minds as they're trying to figure out, what can I do?
Yeah.
And it limits people then, puts people sort of in a situation where they don't do anything.
Yeah. I don't know if this is a question for Sharon or Beryl, but what are some of the situations you see happening in our society today that warrant action by a bystander?
This is Sharon. Mm-hmm. That warrant action?
Yeah.
Well, just about any... We have seen a rise in anti-Semitism, in racist actions, in Islamophobia, in any number of... identity-based actions. And in a way, what we've seen of late in the last couple of years is that people who ordinarily might have, sat on those feelings and not taken action and been reasonably civil have felt empowered to act on those things. And so, consequently, we see a rise in the need for this program and others to urge the vast majority of people to do something.
Mm-hmm. Pamela, when we don't step in, do we bear some responsibility for what happens, do you think?
I firmly believe that we do. And the key word, again, in perpetrators and witnesses is activation. You know, we are all members of our own communities, and I firmly believe that that's where we have the greatest power to make a difference, mm-hmm. by being active as allies, by being active as educators to raise awareness of who we are, you know, who are our neighbors, get to know each other. That is really our calling in a day and age when the culture works against that. So, yes, we have the responsibility, but in particular because I think that others would confirm, too, and affirm that it takes one. There's a lot of inhibition in this for a variety of reasons, and we are all different as individuals, right? And you can't predict every situation. You can't predict any situation. Mm-hmm. The factors are really also movable, or how you'll be feeling in one time. But knowing that, we do bear the responsibility, and the responsibility is that we know one person's action can make a difference to the person on the end of that bias or hatred, and can impel others empower others to take action as well.
Go ahead, Beryl.
And I also think that when people don't act, there's a responsibility also, because then you create a potential complicit, a sense of complicity with the person who's doing the harm. And oftentimes what we've heard is when somebody feels that they didn't do something, they feel bad, they feel guilty, they leave that situation thinking, I should have done something, why didn't I step mm-hmm. in? And that, so it affected not just the person who had been targeted and the person who clearly was doing harm, but also the bystanders who didn't really do. So there is a responsibility to act, to do something, and to, because then you create change. And if you don't, the harm doer might assume that you agree with their actions, that you actually approve.
Yeah.
And no, most people really don't approve of these actions. They really do want to not to see those kinds of events happening in their town.
Yeah, I think you mentioned something, Beryl, that is a shock. Like, you know, when you're watching something happening, at first you're going, is this really happening? So there's a sort of delayed reaction because you are amazed that this is actually happening in front of you. So that can delay your reaction to step in, right? And when we say step in, it isn't always something that's going to be a conflict, right? There are ways to diffuse situations that it doesn't have to result in conflict, right?
Absolutely. I think most people don't want to have this escalate, have a situation escalate or create more conflict. Most people probably just want the thing to go away, the event to go away. So what we can do, and when we step in, what we teach during the active bystander training is to pause and to analyze the situation. So even when you're in shock and you think, okay, what can I do? The training then helps you to think, I can do something. Let me think about what it is I can do. And what's really appropriate in this situation? What can I do that's not going to make it worse? What can I do to help the person who is, or show support for the person who is being targeted? Sometimes even what can I do to have the harm doer save face so that they can get out of the situation too. So there's ways in which it makes us think, and it makes us then choose an appropriate action that for that moment is the best thing that we can do. Now, we don't train people to be superheroes, right? And to sort of fly in there with capes flowing and to try to rescue a person or to make our community great. But it really is a power that we already possess in us that we then exercise because we have given ourselves permission to be able to do something.
Sharon, talk about how you developed the Training Active Bystander curriculum. You consulted with a psychologist, I think you mentioned, educators. How did you put this together?
Well, as I say, we got a crash course in doctoral-level psychology around these issues. We created a curriculum that was massively clunky, and, I mean, like 12 hours long. And then we sat down, we convened reading groups. And these were people who were students, teachers, people from local agencies, from state agencies like Department of Youth Services and DSS at the time, police. We pulled together people from a wide swath of the community to read what we had put together and critique it. From that process, we carved the curriculum down to something that's much more manageable. Now, even with the six-lesson curriculum, it takes a commitment on the part of a school to implement that program. We have to train high school trainers. They have to get out of class to be trained. It's usually a 2 or 3 day training to learn how to teach it. And then they go into classrooms. It may be health class. It may be the English class. It doesn't really matter what class it is. And they teach it, and they teach six lessons. When we do a training for trainers, any trainer can teach the curriculum, and this goes with the school curriculum as well as the 3-hour workshop curriculum. Any trainer can teach with any other trainer. We've put together a curriculum that is really easy to use. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but Sharon, I'm just thinking, you mentioned you training these students to go in and train other students. Mm. Is that sort of that kind of like a peer counseling thing? Is that students will respond more to another student teaching this rather than an adult?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. If you've got someone who's slightly older in the school teaching you, a fellow student, it makes an enormous difference. And it also, what it does is it shifts the culture of the school by having trainers, students who are trainers, teaching other students. We've absolutely seen a shift in the culture in the schools we've been working in for, since 2006-07. So it's a very powerful method. And in the same way, we train trainers from the community in which they're going to be teaching to teach it to their fellow citizens so that it's culturally appropriate. So if you go into a particular town and, you're teaching and maybe some incident happened that's a good learning tool to look at, then everyone, including the trainers, knows what happened. That's a very powerful element. People from the community, whether it's a school or a town or a church or a mosque, they teach. They teach their fellows.
We're talking about training active bystanders. Have you been witness to something you thought was unfair, unjust, or troubling? Did you feel uncomfortable stepping in? Tell us your story. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about training active bystanders. With us is Sharon Tracy, Executive Director of Quabbin Mediation and one of the individuals who developed the Training Active Bystanders Program, Beryl Domingo, who's a Training Active Bystanders Coordinator at Quabbin Mediation, and Pamela Rothstein, member of No Place for Hate, the organization that brought the training to the Cape. 866-999-4626 is our number. Have you been witness to something you thought was unfair, unjust, or troubling, and did you feel uncomfortable stepping in? We'd like to hear your story. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Now, sometimes it might not be apparent that we're witnessing something is wrong. It might seem silly, but, you know, there may be others present, and they don't seem concerned about the situation, and you might be second-guessing yourself, like, should I be? What do you do in that instance?
We talk a little bit about that, because that is oftentimes what people see as a way not to intervene because they're not sure. And we give our attendees of the workshop an example of how that might occur. So then we encourage them then to come up with what can you do in that situation. So it's sort of a real life experience, and then they think through what can we do. So the situation that we describe is a group of young kids, boys, probably teenagers, seemingly having a very loud, boisterous event going on, and you're not sure if a fight is brewing or if they're just being kids having a good time, but you feel as if it's not quite so simple, because what you're witnessing is a little bit troublesome and you feel a little bit concerned. So oftentimes what we would do is, normally other folks would be seeing it too. It's not always just one person witnessing a situation. There's often other people around, and you might want to say, hey, do you think something's going on over there? So a simple question to your other bystanders. So you involve other bystanders also to kind of see, I don't know what's going on over there. Or just go up to the group and say, are you guys okay over here? Simple little statements like that can clear up the confusion that you might have. It's too easy to sort of walk away and just assume that, they're probably just playing and just kind of pretend that nothing is going on. But if you feel that there's something worrisome about what you're seeing, you may want to say and ask, is everything okay over here? Are you okay? Or ask for other folks to see if what they're seeing is what you're seeing.
Yeah. We talked about reasons that some people might be hesitant to chime in. And Garrison just sent us an email. He says, I'm concerned about making a poor judgment somehow. Do you get that much?
True. People do feel like maybe I'm going to be inappropriate in the situation. Maybe I'm going to make a fool of myself. Or I'm maybe calling out a situation that doesn't need to be called out. Active bystandership doesn't have to be you don't have to do something in the moment if you're not sure. We don't always have the right answer or the right response in that moment, but sometimes you can do things after. If you feel, when you go home and you think about it more, you may be able to do something in response to what you've witnessed if you're not sure. So feeling that you're inadequate or not going to handle the situation appropriately, that's okay. Don't be so hard on yourself. Mm-hmm. We're all human, and there are sometimes times when you're just not able to really do anything.
And like you were saying, maybe just asking that question, you're not saying, hey, you boys, knock it off. You're saying, hey, everything okay over here? What are you guys doing?
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. In social media, music, and television, bullying, bias, and degradation of others is normalized. Does this make it more difficult for adolescents to navigate when they should be stepping into situations? Anybody have thoughts on that? I'm just getting smiles.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Sharon. Social media is so interesting. It's like a whole other universe that's been tacked on to, you know, how we interact with each other. One thing that we've found is that particularly the youth that we have trained in this program absolutely use the skills, the Training Act of Bystander skills, when they are on social media. And so the skills that we teach are transferable to that particular medium. I think that your question, you know, youth have a hard time because of social media, the music, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, conflict is normal among human beings. We've been doing it a very long time and are pretty creative about it. We're also very creative about helping each other. So I feel like the underlying elements of humanity are there in whatever medium you're looking at. Mm.
I think also, too, maybe in conversations with young people, that whole, you know, the Facebook and the social media, the reality there is anything but real, right? This is, it's almost like it's a make-believe world. What you're looking at isn't really reality. And I think sometimes for young people, it's hard for them. They want to be that, you know, you're looking at it, your friends who are having all these grand times, and really this might not be a grand time at all. It's being presented that way. It's not a real world.
Well, it's, you know, this is Sharon again. I think it's always good for our educational system and our society to teach people how to analyze what it is they're seeing. And, you know, it's always been an issue.
I would add that social media also removes the human contact, right? So we are the director of lifelong learning at Falmouth Jewish Congregation. So we hear about the anti-Semitic incidents, for instance, in schools. And it's very easy to send somebody an image, to send hateful words and not actually have to encounter them. And whether that's children or adults, that is what is so easily done. Again, coming back to the work of No Place for Hate, it is all person to person. It is getting people to sit down together, get to know each other in a very real, direct, in-person way. It makes a big difference.
Yeah, when you have empathy, it's harder to do that. Yeah, and teaching kids, it's hard to have empathy in social media world, for sure. So how do you help people assess whether or not it's safe to act?
And we stress safety of the individuals throughout the training because, again, our safety is important, the safety of all involved. That's important. We do not expect people to sort of jump in and take action without thinking it through and without sort of analyzing the situation, as Sharon said, is so critical in these situations. There are situations that are truly scary, and people really feel almost immobilized by the fear of being harmed or that somebody's going to get hurt. So when it comes to your own safety, it's better just go with your be cautious, act with caution. Think through what else you can do. Oftentimes, people recruit allies in these situations. When you witness a relatively, let's say it's a situation that verges on violence, you want to then recruit your other bystanders to also together try to do something. It's so much easier than if it's just you trying to intervene and do something. Recruiting allies is a powerful tool to have, and we don't often think about that. These incidents don't happen sort of in isolated places. They oftentimes are happening in public spaces. There's always people around. However, think of our safety first. Think of the safety of the individuals involved in that situation before you act. Now, we've heard of folks when they come to the training, they would say, well, I would just go right up to the guy and I would just smack him right in the face, or I would just call him this and that and the other thing. And that is not what active bystandership is all about. It's really not to become the harm doer yourself.
Or to escalate the situation.
And to escalate the situation, exactly, is to step back. Think through, what can I do here? And sometimes maybe you need to call in for help.
Yeah.
I wanted to add that one of the first examples that was offered at the workshop really set the tone and helped people shift their idea of what are the kind of situations we're talking about, because there is a range. There is when there's already something physical happening, and that heightens the possibility that somebody could get, you know, an active bystander could get hurt as well. But the first example was one of a situation in the supermarket. Beryl can tell it if she wants Then the responses were not what people were thinking, and it really created a shift on what people thought it meant to intervene, which was really a shifting of the molecules rather than an active, sort of aggressive physical intervention.
I like the way you put that, the shifting of the molecules. Yes, actually the reason why I became involved with training active bystanders was an article I read in the Globe a couple of years ago now. And it was about how do you respond in situations that you feel are inappropriate. And the story was a very simple situation of a woman who, she was in a grocery store, and she was pushing her shopping cart, and she was overhearing a white male berating two of the cashiers. And one of the cashiers was a woman of color. And this person, the man, was very rude and certainly belligerent and really escalating. And the woman with the shopping cart, the bystander, thought, oh, I just went through a training active bystander. I should know what to do. I know what I can do. I can do something. And she decided to go towards the people that were involved in this incident. She took her shopping cart. She just gently pushed it towards them between the individuals. And she turned to the shop clerks and just said, you know, the price of apples and the price of oranges seem to keep going up and up and up, but actually in this store that you're doing okay. And she just started talking about the price of food and the price of goods and the grocery store, and she just stopped that interaction. She didn't have to do anything really dramatic. She diverted the attention of the individuals involved. The man walked away, because he was just like flummoxed at this point as to what's going on here. And fortunately, the clerks then could become, you know, themselves again and say, oh, yeah, you're right. We do sell, you know, our fruits and vegetables are really good over here. But it was a very simple act. When I read that story, I thought, this is just a little too simple. But it tweaked my interest, and they mentioned Quabbin mediation. I contacted them. I actually spoke with Sharon, and she described sort of the training. And I said, this is what we need. Because in our community, in Bridgewater, and I don't know if you have time for this, but in Bridgewater, where I'm from, we had a really nasty incident. It was just a few months before I read this article in the paper in 2016 in our post office. There were several people in the post office. It was around Christmas time. And there was a couple who looked like they were from the Middle East. They were dressed sort of in, the woman had a hijab on, and they were standing at the passport window, and there was another woman at the buying stamps. And she suddenly started yelling at this couple and calling them names and saying, you should go back to where you came from. We don't want your type here. And then proceeded to say, you people are terrorists, and you may even have a gun in your pocket. The bystanders froze. They absolutely said nothing, did not know what to do, but essentially didn't do anything. The woman was told by the postmaster to get her business done and leave. This couple left. She followed them and continued to harass them in the parking lot. And that's when people kind of said, look at her. She's still harassing them in the parking lot. But one of the women in the post office, she just felt terrible. She felt that she should have done something. And she went home and wrote this incident on Facebook. She posted it on Facebook, her Facebook. Other folks saw it and were just as outraged as she felt, and really just as sad that this is happening in Bridgewater. And as a result of that posting on Facebook, this is an action she took after the fact. Bridgewater Citizens for Civility and Respect was formed. It's a small community group of people who then came together as a result of this incident and said, you know what, we don't want these kinds of things happening in Bridgewater. This is not what our town is about. And bystander training, training active bystander, reading that article, reading about simple ways to intervene, we thought, we can figure out ways to intervene when we see this. And that's what got us, got me involved.
Yeah, Sharon, I know you wanted to chime in.
Well, that's a great story, Beryl. Thank you. I wanted to mention one thing about the roles of target, harm doer, and bystander, and why we don't go up and whack people, for example. For one thing, it's the whole curriculum, our whole philosophy, is based in nonviolence and respect, even if we might have distaste for people, but treating people with respect. One of the underlying reasons for that is that each of the roles is transformable. So a harm doer today may be an active bystander tomorrow or a target. And conversely, a target might be an active bystander or even a harm doer. We have all done harm, even if it was by accident. And so knowing that, which we talk about, in the workshop, knowing that we have all done harm, even if it was by accident, gives us a certain level of compassion, empathy, something for the harm doer. Because the overall goal is to shift, like you were talking about changing the molecules in people, is to shift the culture and to shift individuals and how they approach other human beings toward the good. Because the other thing is that if harm occurs and is not interrupted and escalates and the harm doer feels like it's okay, the bystanders even think it's okay, that is an unfortunate evolution or devolution of the community. Conversely, if harm happens and is interrupted, then over time people agree this is how we want our community to be. And there is a cultural shift. So the bystander program, it works with individuals and how we respond individually, but also how we respond as a community. Like Beryl was saying, they created this organization in response. So that's what I want.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Have you ever been an active bystander? We'd love to hear your story. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about training active bystanders, training people to analyze situations and assess how to best respond. And with us is Sharon Tracy, Executive Director of Quabbin Mediation and one of the individuals who developed the Training Active Bystanders Program, Beryl Domingo, Training Active Bystanders Coordinator at Quabbin Mediation, and Pamela Rothstein, member of No Place for Hate Falmouth, the organization that brought the training to the Cape. 866-999-4626, if you'd like to share an experience you've had. 866-999-4626 or a question. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Pamela, after having this presentation, this training, what were some of the strategies that you learned from the group coming?
Allowed me to, it was very helpful to hear the kinds of the specific situations that were put forward. And strategies include that you can respond afterwards. And I'll speak for myself as well as, you know, based on the comments that people shared with us. Understanding that simply intervening and changing the conversation, again, diversion is a big tool available to us. And we're able to do that. And frankly, it reinforced my understanding that in active bystander, to become an active bystander, you have to give it a lot of thought beforehand to be able to, under pressure, in a moment where you have to make judgment, a judgment call, and being concerned with your safety, you have to be conscious and thinking about this a lot. Because in a sense, when we split into small groups to address these situations, really everybody in that group, either people weren't sure or people came up with a variety of responses. So that was one of the big takeaways, that there is not one way to do this, that it really depends on the individual, what they've experienced in life, And where they are at that very moment and how they read things. So there was great variation, and and that was one big takeaway. There was not one way other than, again, general diffusion of the situation, and that you can also change, in a sense, deflate the aggression of the perpetrator, in a sense, and that you can, by heightening... You can somehow just, again, treating everybody with dignity and respect has an effect.
Yeah. Beryl, we have, you know, situations where there's mental health issues involved. How do you approach a situation like that? We're not, obviously not trained mental health professionals, and, you know, your diversion may or may not work, right?
That is true. It's not always going to be appropriate or the right thing to do or say, and I think that is a real concern. People have raised that at the training as well in Falmouth, that what if what you're witnessing is really a person with a mental health condition, and they are not really able to change the way they are responding in that situation or change the way they're talking. In the end, I think the responsibility is still upon us to call out behavior that's not appropriate, to still name it, because it may be that that person in that moment is not capable of hearing or not able to control what's going on with them. But it is important that the person who is being targeted hear that this is something that others don't agree with or don't see is a good thing that's happening, that there's a support for that person that's being that the aggression is aimed at. So there are ways that you can intervene without making a judgment call. I think none of us are expected to sort of know when somebody's having a mental health breakdown or if that person has an illness that they that creates the situation. It is important to sort of be aware that that can be, that that's possible. But at the same time, you want to be able to call out the behavior, because it's the behavior that we're addressing and not the individual.
What if we perceive someone is in need of our assistance, but it turns out we misread the interaction, or the person we think we are helping doesn't want us to intervene? How would you handle that situation? There may be a clear, I mean, we see this in domestic violence situations all the time where it's like, no, I don't need any help, because, of course, they're fearing the retaliation later. How do you handle that kind of a situation?
I think these are very good questions, very complicated and complex issues that we face sometimes. If sometimes it's just good to ask, do you need me to do something? Do you need me to call someone? If you're not sure that somebody wants help, some folks may say, no, I don't need your help. Leave me alone. Mm-hmm. And then you really want to respect that person who is saying that. We've heard examples of that at some of our trainings where somebody was giving an example of witnessing a car accident. And when they stopped their car to go and help the individuals in that was in the accident, they were told, don't come near me, don't get any closer, stop where you are, I don't want any help. And it felt awful to the person who was trying to help, but you need to respect that request.
Right. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Denise is giving us a call from Woods Hole. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
I really am enjoying this program, and I just wanted to share two incidents. One, which was many years ago, a racist comment that I was so stunned I did not respond to, and felt shame for years after that, and promised myself if anything like that happened again, I was going to do something. And a few years ago, I was at a reunion at my school, and somebody made an anti-Semitic comment, and I thought, okay, what are you going to do about this? And I just thought for a minute, and then I said to this man whom I knew, please tell me I didn't hear what I think I heard. And there was this dead silence. It was probably a group of 12 people. And he immediately apologized. And later, about three people out of that group came up and thanked me because they had not been able to say anything. Yeah. And I think the whole business of being afraid to say something, I mean, it was not a dangerous situation. This was a perfectly safe one. But I think if you've ever felt the shame of not having done something when you wish you had, that it makes it more imperative to find ways to respond.
Yeah. Denise, that's a great example. And again, not a dangerous situation, but this is a set of friends, right? So you in a way are kind of stepping out because you don't know what that reaction's going to be to the friends that were around in this conversation. Good for you, Denise. Beryl, this is the kind of things we're talking about, right?
Yes. It reminded me of a situation that happened to me. I'm from South Africa originally, grew up there during the apartheid years. I'm a person of color. And in South Africa, I was classified as mixed race or colored. And in coming to the U.S., I felt wonderful being in a country where everybody's treated equally and fairly and so on. I was very young and naive at the time. And where people could express their political opinions and other opinions, even if others may not agree with you, that if as long as it's done in a polite and respectful manner. And I was having, among a circle of friends, we were talking about I can't remember the situation, but I was obviously had strong opinions about something. And the person who suddenly, one of the people in the group said, if you don't like it here, go back to Africa. And I was stunned because I was thinking I didn't say really anything terrible. I started to second guess myself. What did I say? Why did I solicit this reaction? The individual was really angry at me, and I felt as very small and completely insulted and totally belittled and in shock. And no one else came to my defense. And this was a person who I thought was a friend. Mm. And I now, of course, because of incidents like that, I have a lot of empathy and certainly for anyone who people are calling them names, where racial slurs, any kind of slur is used to berate a person and put a person down. And I always feel that I will never allow that to happen to other people because I know how that felt. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can put ourselves in the position of others who we may never experience it ourselves, but we can imagine what it might feel like. And again, like as Sharon said, we all have been targets at some point or another, small ways or big ways. People may have gossiped about us, taunted us, and we felt bad. So we know what that feels like. And if we put ourselves in that position, we definitely can feel the power to help.
Yeah. Kind of two themes I'm hearing here in this hour. Empathy is one. And the other is like we keep on analyzing the situation. And all I can think of is, as you're saying this is what we train, police officers, first responders. This is their training, right, is analyze the situation. So this is, in a way, we're doing that same thing.
Well, I wanted to add that certainly the training that's offered in the military is a good model for how communities and educational institutions can deal with this, because you have to be prepared at all times. You need to stay trained, right? You need to be exposed to different situations. And the more you have that repeated exposure, the more we share stories so that we actually know what the situation is. We have a real propensity, I think, on the Cape to not share. It's not quite part of the culture to come out and to start sharing these kinds of stories if you haven't yourself witnessed, which clearly is a motivator to act at a future time. I think amongst those 65 people in that room, hearing the scenarios that were put forward as real scenarios and hearing some that were shared by people present was akin, let's say, theoretically, to experiencing it. It prodded them to understand what the type of situation might be, to understand how you might respond, and it elicited that outrage, empathy. So it doesn't have to be your own experience. It can be that one that you hear. So I certainly can say that No Place for Hate offered this with that intent to have people trained and to share stories, and certainly wants to continue to offer trainings to enable people, because it is that repetitive, recurring ability to step up. Right. That's important. Yeah.
I think also when you bring a whole a community together in that way, oftentimes when we see or hear of these events, we feel outraged in our own living room, or we're in front of our computer looking at Facebook. But when we see all these other people in our community that come together and that feel the same way, that think the same way, that want to do the right thing, want to know what can I do, it's so empowering to have with 65 people there. I was, even though it was a very large group, it was great because it showed each one there that these are the people who care, that they care about others, they care about their community, they want a community that where people are treated with respect and dignity, where people feel welcome. And that's really, and then with that power of the group, think about the things you can do. Individually, we have power, but a group has so much more power.
Yeah. Pamela, we know that the superintendent of the Falmouth Public Schools, as well as the school resource officer from Falmouth, both attended the training. We invited them to join us today, but their schedules didn't allow. What was the feedback from them or others about the training?
Well, feedback was very positive, and we, you know, it wasn't coincidental that the superintendent and her staff were there. We've been working with the schools for years. Again, you know, these kinds of very human relationships and trust and mutual understanding come through years of work. It's pleasurable and respectful and wonderful work. So we told them about it right away. And they also responded right away, understanding the importance. So, and we also debrief with them at least initially right away. And I think there's interest in the schools. I certainly hope so. We, No Place for Hate, is very interested in getting this kind of training into the schools, whether the schools handle that or whether we collaborate with them. And consistently in No Place for Hate, and I think reflecting this odd kind of demographic that it's in cultural situation we have on the Cape with less contact, direct contact than you would in other communities between seniors and children, because so many seniors move to the Cape without having families. But people are genuinely and intensely interested in seeing this brought into the youth population.
Sharon, we have about a minute left. Anything you want to add before we end the program?
I don't think so. Yeah, okay. I think you've covered quite a lot of ground this hour. Thank you.
Yeah, Beryl?
I think that if the No Place for Hate group decide to do a training for trainers, it would be wonderful, because then you have people from your community who can do trainings in the Cape is a large place.
Yeah. So, Beryl, who do you think would most benefit from this type of training? We talked about students. Are there other groups that that you think would be, you know, really beneficial to do this?
I think police officers, first responders, town council people, city council people.
Mm-hmm. And then again, as you were saying, Pamela, we don't often talk about these kinds of issues. You know, people aren't you know, really reticent to come up and tell us their stories right away. So education is key here.
Absolutely. Education of each other within the community, education within the schools. And I would also add one other group that hasn't been mentioned, which is the business community. So right. Key in training businesses, training their employees. Issues of bias are acted out often in commercial establishments, and the trickle down of this message is very, very important.
All right. We'll post links to No Place for Hate, Falmouth, and Quabbin Mediation's Training Active Bystanders Program at our website, capeandislands.org. Sharon Tracy, Executive Director of Quabbin Mediation, Beryl Domingo, Training Active Bystanders Coordinator at Quabbin Mediation, and Pamela Rothstein, member of Falmouth's No Place for Hate, the organization that brought the training to the Cape. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it. Great conversation this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistants from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.